This week's episode was brought to you by Dylan Anthony, Varda, and Matt A. Thank you, Dylan Anthony, Varda, and Matt A. It's with the generous support of listeners just like you that keeps our hydroponic brain farm growing new and exotic forms of gray matter that we wire up to a networked series of large ionized barrels of liquefied cheese created from the rancid milk of a cursed dairy cow named Lester, which provides the devil a material basis for manifestation so we can use it to calibrate our new color photo printer. If you'd like to help us set up our new printer, or just hear the second half of this episode, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the second half of this episode, but the second half of our entire library of episodes, which are conveniently browsable from right within Spotify. But that's not all. I'll even send you a 5x5 high quality vinyl sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, and you'll get the secret keys to our Discord server, where we trade macaroni and cheese recipes of the devil. If you're enjoying the free section of the show just fine and would rather save your $5 to refill your label maker, then please consider giving us a like, subscribe, or share in your social media platform of choice. Heck, if you've got friends, try telling one about the show and see if their brains explode, you know, for science. On the flip side, if you'd like a limited edition holographic sticker and our show notes, our $10 tier is for you. For our big spenders, $20 will get you a monthly tarot reading from yours truly. They're actually pretty informative. On this week's episode, we explore the occult classic Psychic Self-Defense by the illustrious and sometimes problematic Dion Fortune. With Fortune as our guide, we discuss the practical wisdom of how to deal with a psychic attack, the precautions you should take to avoid it, and a whole lot of practical occult theory to help us understand how it all works. In the free section of the show, topics include signs of psychic attack, how the subconscious mind works to curse or protect us, to banish or not to banish, how to send a psychic attack, the etheric double, natural witches, vampires, hauntings, and we even discuss a few inappropriately antiquated racial stereotypes that rear their ugly head within the text. In the extended edition of the show, we discuss the first lines of defense against a psychic attack and how to respond on the physical plane before jumping headfirst into a step-by-step explanation of how to perform both the highly protective Kabbalistic cross and lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram. Thank you, and enjoy the show. Walks into a magic forest to cut down a tree. Upon arrival, he started to swing at the tree when it shouted, "Wait, I'm a talking tree!" The man grinned and said, "And you will dialogue." Did you hear about the short fortune teller who escaped from prison?
Nope.
He was a small medium at large.
Oh, that's a good one.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just tell you about the profoundly dangerous paranormal hotspots with enough unbalanced energy to open portals and suck out a cow's anal glands. Nay, we explore the occult methodologies intended to throw off parasitic alien influence and create a plasmatic exosphere of pure radiant spiritual energy that cuts evil spirits like so many gangsters in the Beat It music video, because this week, we're discussing, with a little bit of help from Dion Fortune, psychic self-defense. I'm your host, Hack Rabbit, known by mortal men as Luke Madrid. I'm joined this week by the mystic doggy monarch, Mari-sama.
Awoo!
The magical machine mutant, Malachor 5.
What's up?
And the heavenly hodgepodge, Heka Astra.
Hello.
I can't believe I waited till now to crack open this book. I don't know how many times I've read Dion Fortune's mystical Kabbalah, but this is the first time my eyes have ever graced the pages of Psychic Self-Defense. I hear it was a big favorite of David Bowie's, in fact.
Really?
Yeah, he loved this book. He would take it with him everywhere. He studied it all the time.
That can explain a lot, actually, about why he's so freaking cool, because Dion Fortune is pretty freaking cool too.
Her writing reminds me a little bit of chaos magic before there was chaos magic. You know what I mean?
Totally.
You get a lot of information, some good firsthand accounts, and it's like personal and compelling all at the same time.
And I find her poetry really beautiful as well. And she talks about many different areas of the world that she seems to have distilled and extracted their esoteric knowledge from.
And then she says inappropriately racist things at times, which we are also going to talk about.
Yes, she does say some of those things too.
Oh boy.
So to get started, across many cultures, there are rich traditions and or methods to ward off evil or bad luck. Things like knocking on wood, the use of jack-o'-lanterns during Halloween times, Native American dream catchers to protect our dreams from becoming nightmares. You even see it on boats in bygone eras. The figureheads that are at the front of the ships had fearsome, bug-eyed, sharp-toothed beings that were said to scare off evil spirits and grant the sailors safe passage to their destination.
You know, they do that on airplanes too. Like, they do it today, but the ones I'm thinking of stand out from World War II. They'd put, like, a red mouth with, like, sharp teeth and blood on it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that I didn't even think of that comparison. It like a flying shark kind of thing on an AC-130, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird because you can see a boat coming, you know what I mean? But a plane is so high and so fast, it's like, the enemy's not really going to see that. I don't know. Anyway, please continue.
Right. But it's been a long-standing trait for us humans to use tactics like those that we just mentioned to get an upper hand in life or particular situations and not be at the mercy of otherworldly forces. In the realm of ceremonial magic, mages old and new claim to be in close contact or even masters over those forces. So just to put it out there bluntly, if you memorize and master the lessons and some of the things we're going to cover in this episode, you might be able to call yourself an adept.
Honestly, in terms of show topics, this is one we probably should have done long ago.
Definitely should have did this before telling people how to invoke demons.
Oh, oops. Adeptship aside, learning proper psychic self-defense may be as far as some people ever need to penetrate into the witchy world of occultism. And, as you suggested, Mal, it's essential for anybody wishing to survive the study and practice thereof, at least in any long-term capacity. To read from the seminal occult classic and source text for this episode, Psychic Self-Defense, author Dion Fortune explains,
"We live in the midst of invisible forces whose effects alone we perceive. We move along invisible forms whose actions we very often do not perceive at all, though we may be profoundly affected by them.
And furthermore,
there are beings that live in this invisible world as fish live in the sea. There are men and women with trained minds or special aptitudes who can enter this invisible world as a diver descends to the ocean bed. There are also times when, as happens to land when the sea dikes break, the invisible forces flow in upon us and swamp our lives."
This may be more true now than ever, as the modern world we inhabit today has evolved such that we are bombarded incessantly with sophisticated, even weaponized forms of advertisement that penetrate our daily routines through our smart devices, which we in turn depend upon more and more every day. Combine this with runaway inflation, rampant paranoia, and epic levels of loneliness, we are more vulnerable to psychic attack and its disastrous fallout than ever.
It's not just being bombarded by, like, advertising and movies and media and all that, or even people in that, well, like, people talking to you, I mean. But if you're an empath, if you're a hyper-empathetic person, other people's thoughts can be intrusive on your own, and you may not even know it's happening. Like to say also these practices help, like, if you're overwhelmed by crowds or, you know, easily distracted and things like that, this can also help with that.
That being said, not all forms of psychic attack are equal, and as Fortune explained, knowing the difference is important.
"We must consider the outward and visible signs of psychic attack before we are in a position to analyze the nature of such attacks and indicate their source of origin. It is a fundamental rule that diagnosis must precede treatment. There are many different kinds of psychic attacks, and the methods that will dispose of one will be ineffectual against another."
In fact, as she explains, many forms of attack happen entirely by accident. These attacks are actually the most common and are said to be issued from, quote, the ignorant or malignant mind of our fellow human beings. This may even occur where the source of the psychic damage is passed down from another victim by no intention or fault of theirs onto you, just as electricity may conduct between people to deadly effect. For this reason, Fortune warns that it is ill-advised to counterattack, and, as more often than not, this too is dangerous, energy-consuming, and ineffective compared to the more, quote, humane methods of basic self-defense. And it doesn't always come from people either. As we discussed last week in the case of Skinwalker Ranch, encountering dangerous psychic currents is possible in certain areas where the energy is highly concentrated. That being said, getting to know the signs of being attacked are our first line of defense and the surest way to fight back in the case of an ongoing one. Fortune explains that even the dullest of people with hardly any self-awareness about their own psyche can still often feel a sense of oppression and general malaise, which then lifts as they go away to another place. That is, in fact, if the psychic attack is coming from a location. However, even in such a case, leaving a psychic attack unchecked can lead to years of poor health and misery. More commonly, however, if somebody is sufficiently oppressed, they will often become the subject of nightmares, which, in their more potent form, will sometimes be accompanied by a feeling of weight on the chest, almost as if one is being kneeled or sat upon, even to the point of making it hard to breathe, Fortune explains.
If the sense of weight is present, it is certain that the attack emanates locally, for the weight is due to the concentration of etheric substance, or ectoplasm, and is sufficiently tangible to press down the scale of a balance when it is possible to capture it for measurement. In other words, this spirit stuff can actually affect and weigh down in real life, like as a material, but seems to still be a presence.
Yeah, it seems like this negative energy of sorts builds up so much in the astral, and it gets so thick that it almost becomes physical upon your body.
You know, they say the human soul is 21 grams. Apparently, Satan's foot is like 2.5-3 pounds.
Damn.
I know, right? It's crazy.
This sense of fear and oppression are explained as the first hints that an attack is underway, and negative energies begin to affect the subconscious mind before they take a foothold in the physical world. So it's kind of like you'll just have like a bad feeling. That's like how you know it's coming.
A sinking feeling.
Yes.
And then you become sluggish or perhaps can't make a decision quick enough. Those kind of things.
So like a week or two before the lockdowns, I was at work with a coworker, and we both had this intense, looming sense of dread that something really bad was going to happen. And we spent all day being like, do you feel that too? And it's like, yeah, I feel that. What do you think that is?
Yeah, we can't forget that that's a possible feeling that humans can have. You know, mages and wizards of the past have talked about how they can feel things. We call them empaths nowadays. There's all kinds of different terms for, you know, a psychic person. Even just yesterday, I felt like I was freaking dying. I probably would have died if my body stood in the state it was for a few days. My brain probably cooked because I had a really high fever. And I had to write for this episode. And I was, as I was writing it, I was telling myself mentally, like, you know, that classic pain is weakness leaving the body. So sometimes, like, psychically, that is going to happen to you where you're going to feel bad because it's like, it's going, like the spell is being cast. It's like a sludge wash, or, you know, a spiritual cleaning that you're doing, or that's happening, whether you're in control of it or not. That's one way I interpret those types of phenomena. It's also like a form of divination. It's a divination could feel like that sometimes, and those don't feel good at all. And you need to be able to control that feeling if you're making money off of being a fortune teller, I guess.
The reason for this is that we perceive subconsciously before we realize consciously, and a line of creeping shade indicates the penetrating of the subconscious sensor from below upwards. As the attack progresses, nervous exhaustion becomes increasingly marked, and there may, under certain conditions, which we will consider later, be such wasting of the tissues that the victim is reduced to a mere bloodless shell of skin and bones, lying on the bed, too weak to move, and yet no definite disease can be demonstrated.
Sounds like me yesterday.
Oh, man.
You know what I hear is good if you're being attacked by empaths? Empanadas. I'm so sorry.
Empanada.
If the attack is unable to take a foothold, the negative energies may well up between the mental and physical dimension, which the victim experiences as horrible nightmares that may push them to attempt the impossible task of trying to avoid sleep entirely, like that one horror movie with the guy with the hands. Eventually, however, the effects on the subtle body begin to manifest as physical symptoms, and after a night or astral struggle, the dreamer may even awaken with bruises on their body. What's intriguing about this phenomenon is that it's been well observed by mainstream medical science. This condition, known as psychogenic purpura, or sometimes Gardner-Diamond syndrome, is when psychological trauma or hypnotic suggestion induces actual physical bruising. As we've discussed on the show in the past, it was our exorcism episode, this is repeatable under lab conditions, and is often the medical explanation given for inexplicable injuries suffered during demonic possession.
Damn, that's some serious stuff.
Yes, so fast forward from 1930 to today, it is a medical fact that being slapped in your dream can leave a bruise.
Damn, that witch got hands.
Like, that's not even occultism or fringe. It's legit science.
That's why when you shit yourself in a dream, you probably shit yourself in real life.
Aw, come on. Evil odors are another manifestation of an astral attack. The characteristic smell is of decomposing flesh, and it comes and goes capriciously. But while it is manifesting, there is no doubt whatever about it, and anyone who is present can smell it, whether they are psychic or not.
And if they can't, you're having a stroke.
Usually that chalks down to, you know, a squirrel crawled in your walls and died.
Now, as we've discussed many times on the show, often paranormal, UFO, or cryptid activity is accompanied by a strong smell of ozone, kind of like bleach, rancid body odor, blood, or sulfur, you know, like rotten eggs. I'd heard a really cool theory on the podcast, Where Did the Road Go? They were discussing how the sulfur smell may be due to something chemical, because oftentimes these entities can like dissipate very quickly and like poof into nothing, that perhaps that smell was demanifesting. I don't know. I thought it was a cool idea. Dionne Fortune also claims, though she had not seen it herself as of writing the book, that slime or ectoplasm is sometimes said to accompany psychic attack. You know, like in Ghostbusters.
Can you please insert the Bustin' Makes Me Feel Good sound effect here? Bustin'
makes me feel good. Will do.
Thank you.
It's either you got attacked by Slimer or you were hanging out with Dan Schneider.
Yeah, but at that point, we always know the psychic attack is from Dan Schneider if it only manifests on your feet.
Don't even go there. We're going to get sued. He's got lawyers. Now, although similar to stories we've heard from Skinwalker Ranch, mysterious footsteps that begin or end out of nowhere are also possible signs of psychic attack.
So like Metal Gear, whose footprints are these?
Yeah, or you're about to get choked out by a very sensual, deep-voiced man who's going to kidnap you for his own paramilitary organization if he trains that ass.
Yo, I'm about to do some ghost busting myself.
And for the Bloodborne fans out there, like Malachor and Hekka, Fortune mentions the idea of an astral bell, which can sometimes indicate a breach between the astral and physical realms.
This sound varies from a dear bell-like note to a faint click. I have often heard it resemble the sound made by striking a cracked wine glass with a knife blade.
She explains that while this is not always indicative of a threat, it often accompanies other signs of psychic attack, and if it does, it can be used to diagnose that it is just that.
Inexplicable outbreaks of fire are also sometimes seen in this connection. These indicate that elemental forces, not human, are at work. Poltergeist phenomena also occur, in which objects are flung about, bells rung, and other noisy manifestations take place. Of course, there may be a multiplicity of phenomena, more than one type appearing at the same case.
Man, that's gotta be scary to have a ghost that's so pissed at you it can just light stuff on fire. This girl is on fire! Thankfully, the method by which psychic attack is accomplished is easy to understand and works on a principle we are familiar with in psychology and politics: the power of suggestion. The twist here, especially important for the occultists in the group, is that suggestion is capable of operating through telepathic means. While this may give us more to consider, the idea is fundamentally unchanged. In all cases, the end result is the same, the difference being where the suggestion originates. Dionne Fortune identifies three avenues where suggestion may enter the mind: auto-suggestion, from the self, conscious suggestion, from the outside, and hypnotic suggestion, which is intended to bypass the conscious mind, which we experience as the ego, and it functions like a filter. You get past the filter, bang. The important part in each of these cases is that these suggestions will only bloom into reality when they are planted in the fertile soil of the subconscious mind. Fortune's description of the subconscious mind will sound familiar, as it's often repeated in later texts about new thought, like The Secret, and chaos magic.
The subconscious mind belongs to a much earlier phase of evolution than the conscious mind. Belongs, in fact, to a phase prior to the development of speech. To address it in words, therefore, is like speaking to a man in a language he does not understand. In order to deal with him, we must resort to sign language. So it is with the subconscious mind. It is no use to say to it, do this, or don't do that. We must make a mental picture of the thing we want done and hold it in consciousness till it begins to sink into the subconsciousness. The subconscious mind will understand this picture and act upon it.
Awesome.
How many New Age channelers have made $1 million just repeating that one paragraph in different ways?
Probably a lot.
Like, that's the whole thing. So this is why mythology and symbolism is important in things as common as TV shows and obscure as ceremonial magic. Heck, even animals think using symbols. As such, mastery of this symbolic faculty is important to affecting manifestation. The advice which follows is often repeated in newer schools of thought and magic as well.
The actor who wishes to cure himself of stage fright will fail to do so if he says to his subconscious mind,
"Don't be frightened."
For a nod is as good as a wink to a blind horse. Equally, if he makes a mental picture of stage fright and says to his subliminal self,
"Now don't do that."
The result will be disastrous, for the subliminal self will see the picture and omit the negative because the word not means nothing to it. In order to handle the subconscious mind effectually, we make a mental picture of the thing we want done and hold it in mind by repeated applications until the subconsciousness begins to be influenced and takes up the task of its own accord.
This, of course, requires bypassing the filter of the conscious mind and impressing upon the deeper subconscious mind using the language it understands. Symbolism. If this can be accomplished, the target of the suggestion will usually only become aware of it only after it has come to fruition, appearing to have happened as if by magic. In essence, it is magic.
Yeah.
The fact psychological mechanisms are involved is just part of how it all works together. But there is an all-important caveat which rectifies quite a bit of confusion about this subject on the power of magic in general. Essentially, the thing to remember here is that a pig and an elephant's DNA just don't splice.
What now?
You heard me, a pig and an elephant's DNA just don't splice.
Does it look like a pig or an elephant?
Take it away, Mari.
For growth of the thought seeds of suggestion to take place, they must find a congenial soil. It is herein lies the strength of the defense. We may not be able to prevent the minds of others from sending us suggestions, but we may so purify the soil of our own natures that no harmful ones can find a congenial seedbed. It is a simple matter to put up a seedling nettle, but it is quite a different business to eradicate a thick-set bank of tangled roots and stinging shoots many years old.
So without overstating it, this is why some schools of magic thought do not place as much emphasis on banishing rituals, because the focus is placed on tending to the astrosome or energetic body such that attacks or malignant thought forms will be entirely unable to take hold, while banishing rituals are still used. Schools like Ordo Astri, my favorite brand of Thelema, sees their use a bit closer to how we might see antibiotics in medical science, where, as potent as they can be for curing certain diseases, if used too frequently, they can disrupt the natural flora in the gut. Apparently, it can be the same with banishing. It is for the same reason. Even in classical Golden Dawn practice, you are instructed, at least under normal conditions, to not banish the archangels, the astral equivalent to one's healthy gut flora. That being said, a powerful psychic attack is precisely the thing you'd want to use antibiotics for. But we'll talk shop about how banishing works later.
I mean, a lot of this advice also occurs to me too as just good practical information for maintaining your mental health.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you think about it, the etheric and spiritual plane of existence is that place that our mind is anyway.
As above, so below, as they say.
It's interesting that it works for good things and bad things because, as we're familiar with now, Christ in the Gospels of Thomas is like, my message is like a mustard seed, and your brain might just be too stupid to comprehend it. But maybe it's not. It works that way with bad things too, where like if somebody's extremely neurotic and sensitive, they're easier to like spin out with a psychic attack. Whereas like, you know, thick brain, don't care grug, it's going to be impossible.
Oh yeah, that's a good point.
Just getting this mental image of like a astral biker with like two tumbleweeds for tires, and the tumbleweeds are all his problems.
That's Russian thistle, and Russian thistle's always a problem. Now that we know what to expect from a psychic attack, Fortune lays out exactly how a psychic attack may be undertaken using principles familiar to Egyptian magic.
Let us now consider exactly how a psychic attack operates. In the realms of mind, there is neither time nor space as we understand them. I do not propose to argue this statement philosophically, but state it as a fact of experience with anyone who is accustomed to operating on the inner planes will have shared. If we think of a person, we are in touch with that person. If we picture them clearly, it is as if we were face to face with them. If we picture them vaguely, it is as if we saw them in the distance. Being in the mental vicinity of a person, we can create a thought atmosphere by dwelling upon certain ideas in connection with him or her. This is how spiritual healing is done. The affirmations of Christian Science are used in order to get the mind of the healer into a certain emotional state, and his condition effectually influences the mind with whom he has put himself in rapport.
What does it mean if you whack off to somebody?
They might see you.
So I thought it was interesting that this principle of sending suggestions astrally was not included explicitly in her list a few paragraphs prior. Nonetheless, the same strengths and weaknesses from normal psychological ingress are at play. Fortune explains that due to its primitive nature, messages sent to the subconscious mind must be couched in, quote, very simple terms. Furthermore, the atmosphere within the soul must be primed to correspond with the suggestion.
The primary aim of the suggestion is to create a mental atmosphere about the soul of the person, whether that person is to be attacked or healed, until a sympathetic response or reaction is elicited within the soul itself. I use the term soul to include both the mental and emotional processes, but to exclude the spiritual ones. Once this reaction is achieved, the battle is half over, for the gate of the city has been opened from within, and there is free ingress. The telepathic suggestion of definite ideas can now proceed rapidly. So it's basically like getting your foot in the door or breaking down the wall, and then everything can rush in very quickly.
Yeah, you have to prime your target to crack from the inside and open their doors to you, is what she's saying. Mm-hmm. Fortune then explains, the quickest way to achieve this is to couch the suggestion being fired in terms that appeal to the self-preservation or sex instinct.
How does the attacker proceed? He has to create an atmosphere about the soul of his victim on the inner planes. He can only do this by creating that atmosphere within his own consciousness while he thinks of his victim. If he wants to perform a psychic murder, he must fill his own soul with the rage of destruction until it overflows. If he wants to perform a psychic rape, he must fill his soul with lust and cruelty. The cold rage of cruelty is essential to the effectual operations of this nature. Now, what happens when he does this? He has sounded a ringing keynote in the abyss. It will be answered. All beings who have this keynote for the basis of their nature will respond. Dark Uriel and Azrael and Amon on the wing and will join in the operation, but they do not operate direct upon the victim. They work through the operator.
The good news, Fortune claims, is that if we do not allow our inner game to be shaken by these attacks, they will be unable to find their mark, and this is how we truly have the advantage.
We have considered the modus operandi of telepathic suggestion in detail because it forms the real basis of every kind of occult attack, whether it be a discarnate entity, a being of another order of evolution, a demon from the pit, or merely the panic-stricken soul of a selfish friend, clinging to the life form regardless of consequences. In all case, the opening gambit is the same. Until the aura is pierced, there could be no entrance into the soul, and the aura is always pierced from within by the response of fear or desire going out towards the attacking entity. If we can inhibit that instinctive emotional reaction, the edge of the aura will remain impenetrable and will be as sure a defense against psychic invasion as the healthy and unbroken skin is a defense against bacterial infection.
It's a lot like how it's said in Dune, fear is the mind killer.
Mm-hmm.
Or Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Relax, don't
do it. And why do you think sex and violence are the most popular, you know, media of all time?
My aura is so thirsty.
And to note also, your subconscious being the lower form of your brain, the lizard brain, it's always focused on reproduction and survival. So makes sense.
This is why the ruling class acting as lizards is a valuable metaphor, if not literal, because it's probably not. Because that's how they keep you in the matrix, is with your lizard brain. Oh, you want sex? Oh, you want food? Oh, you want sex? Oh, how about some violence? How about some sex? How about some threats?
Now pay your taxes, bitch. My cloaca aches for your money.
Ew.
Uh-oh. Somebody's been a bad lizard.
I wish I could do the PB Herman voice from Nice Dreams, because he's like,
ah, Mr. Lizard, a monster. Would you care for a hamburger?
Now, in some cases, we are warned, the infection is chronic in that a person has formed a sort of rapport with the attacking entity, and external assistance is often required in such a case. Even worse, the victim is often disinclined to sever the bond, as it may have spanned several lifetimes, or they might just be fond for the entity.
That was our first date, hmm? You pulled me up with your strong arms.
Of course, allowing an attack to continue over long periods can have disastrous effects on physical health, as our astral double, the soul damaged by such attacks, is the very thing which holds our physical form together on a cellular level. In fact, malignant forms of cancer are seen as the result of damage to our astral body or double.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
I think Hideo Kojima plays with this to quite an extent in Death Stranding, just to throw that out there.
Yeah, totally agree.
Well, she goes on to explain the etheric double. The etheric double is primarily a body of magnetic stresses in the framework of whose meshes every cell and fiber of the physical body is held as in a rack. But intermediate between this and the dense physical body as we know it, there is what may be called the raw material out of which dense matter is condensed. This was called by the ancients hyle, or first matter, and by the moderns, ectoplasm. It is this projected ectoplasm which produces the phenomena whenever physical manifestations are in question. It may be projected as long rods, which will operate up to a distance of a dozen feet or so, where it may be projected as a nebulous cloud, connected with the medium by a tenuous thread. This cloud can be organized into distinct forms, having the semblance of life and acting as vehicles for conscious wills.
I want my cloud to be in the shape of a Lamborghini.
Just quick question about this specifically. I've heard of people doing readings where they look at your aura, and a lot of times, if you're manifesting a thought form by thinking about something really hard, they can see a shape of it in your aura. Would this be the material at which the image is formed?
If I had to answer earnestly, I believe that the ectoplasm in question here is like the next step down from that, like
where it's
right before,
like,
it
almost manifesting.
Yeah, it's like the in-between place between what you're describing and the physical manifestation. It's a bit like astral stem cells, is how she's explaining it.
Oh, okay. So it's like beginning to take form.
Yeah, like the thought form in Yesod becomes like some goop. Ectoplasm in the machinery of the universe as it descends towards the material universe.
And then
that goop hardens into the thing being manifested.
Yeah, it's kind of like our bodily fluids that secrete when we get horny.
Oh, like those rods she was talking about, the 12-foot rods.
Well, you know, 12 feet's awfully long. That being said, yes, ectoplasm is very similar to like sperm or like the lady juices, right? And then, of course, when you do psychedelics or eat mushrooms, your face, usually your eyes and nose, also issue this goop. And I guess somewhere along the line, people conceived like, okay, well, semen and pussy juice make things. So ghosts, it's ghost juice. I don't know.
Oh, boy.
That's kind of what I mean by that. Yeah, it's the pre-cum right before it's going to be physical.
I'm going to manifest.
Oh, I'm coming.
I'm coming into existence.
No, I'm manifesting into physical form. Ah! And that's what the Buddhists believe. Like, oh, look at those people. Oh, no, they're my parents. Fuck. Welcome back to the terrarium. Now get out there and make some money for your reptilian overlords. You think all this suffering is free?
So, yes.
As mentioned earlier, most cases of psychic attack happen entirely by accident. The problem is that some people don't need to attack you on purpose for it to be deadly. Somebody's astral body could even decide to attack involuntarily during sleep, like a wet dream, but for vengeance. Dion Fortune goes as far to suggest that those with natural psychic temperament or sensitivity have likely learned it during a past life working in covens of medieval witchcraft.
She's a witch! Burn her!
Fortune then recounts her experience meeting one of these unwitting past life as a witch type ladies, which caused her live-in spiritual study group cult and herself a considerable amount of magical trouble, albeit accidentally. Well, the book goes into exhaustive detail. A paraphrasing of the nature and quality of the conflagration here may prove elucidating. Long story short, in her youth, Dion Fortune invited an acquaintance, referring to her as Miss L, to join her at an occult lodge to study the esoteric arts, but shortly after arriving, a number of the students began to experience restless nights and, from the sounds of things, bouts of sleep paralysis paired with heavy airs of malevolence. Then, any time this was discussed in Miss L's presence, she would react with intense revulsion as if the conversation itself were unlucky. Sometime later, Miss L had attempted to gossip and play matchmaker with Fortune, who, being averse to such things, the prude that she is, found the interaction evolving into an argument. Following, it was evident that some serious resentment had been stirred up from both parties. Fortune then explains.
That night I was afflicted with the most violent nightmare I had ever had in my life, waking from sleep with the terrible sense of oppression on my chest, as if someone were holding me down or lying upon me. I saw distinctly the head of Miss L, reduced to the size of an orange, floating in the air at the foot of my bed and snapping its teeth at me. It was the most malignant thing I had ever seen.
You guys ever seen that meme with that little orange with like the human eyeballs and the mouth and he's like,
yeah,
looking?
That was a shitty show on Adult Swim. It sucks. Let's not talk about it.
Well, that's what I'm imagining.
It's horrifying. Actually, yes, it is terrifying. The annoying orange.
Fortune recounts that afterwards, it was not uncomfortable. Common for a cloud of malevolent feeling to descend as bedtime approached. Upon awakening, the heavy, archaic front door of the college would be, well, mysteriously open, along with a number of other bedroom doors within, but no intruders could be found. Things only got better after Miss L snapped entirely one day.
Miss L and I were peacefully at work in the kitchen when she suddenly caught up a carving knife and started after me, as mad as a March hare. Fortunately for me, I had in my hands a large saucepan full of freshly boiled greens, and I used business as a weapon of defense, and we danced around the kitchen table, slopping hot cabbage water in all directions. We neither of us made a sound. I fended her off with a hot and sooty saucepan, and she slashed at me with an unpleasantly large carving knife. At a psychological moment, in walked the head of the community. He took in the situation at a glance, and handled it by the tactful method of scolding us both impartially for making so much noise and telling us to get on with our work. Miss L finished whatever she was doing with the carver, I dished up the cabbage, and the incident passed off quickly. After lunch, Miss L experienced the reaction from her excitement and went to her room completely prostrated with exhaustion. I was somewhat perturbed. Although used to mental cases, and therefore not as disturbed by the recent fracas as anyone else might have been, I did not relish the prospect of being the housemate of a dangerous lunatic who was under no sort of control. The head of the community, however, said there was no cause for alarm. He would soon have the case in hand. He went up to the bathroom, filled a soap dish with water from the tap, made certain passes over it, and dipping his finger into the water, proceeded to draw a five-pointed star upon the threshold of Miss L's room. Miss L made no attempt to leave her room until 48 hours later when he fetched her out himself. As he had promised, he soon had her in hand.
They would all later conclude that Miss L had been a witch in a past life whose proclivities for dark sorcery had smoldered within her current incarnation's private self as a natural impulse.
As a child, she used to daydream that she was a witch, willing the death or misfortune of those who annoyed her. And she also averred, though whether this was true or not I cannot say, that her wishes were so effectual that she was frightened and tried to abandon the practice. She also volunteered that she was in the habit of visualizing herself standing before people she was angry with, scolding them and projecting malignant force at them. This, of course, would explain our nightmares. She also said that she had been in the habit of attacking her mother and sister in this way, which had made her sister very ill, so that they now refused to have her in the house. This statement was later confirmed by the mother.
So this Miss L was just really making people feel like shit wherever she went.
Yeah, because she didn't have it, you know, she didn't have it under control. So it would just leak out whenever she was afraid or angry at someone, it would just come out.
I have some very personal things to say about this, but I'm going to save it for the extended show because I genuinely don't want the public at large to just hear it. Although I will say this, it sounds like Miss L was doing it on accident. She didn't fully appreciate that her inner fantasy world was causing very negative effects in the real life people that she was thinking of.
I chalk it up to this physical, non-physical, symmetrical relationship of you start to do certain things with your behavior, you're gonna bring out the inner demons just because you created a symmetrical situation between a physical aspect and a non-physical aspect. It becomes the same thing, like a fractal.
What's crazy to me is that it's happening on accident. Like, she's making people sick and giving them nightmares just by being angry at them. Like I said, we'll talk more about this soon. Running parallel to the accidental witch, of course, is the accidental vampire, more commonly referred to in the modern occult parlance as the psychic vampire. Although popularized by Anton LaVey some 40 years later, the basic idea behind the psychic vampire was laid out here first by Fortune. As fate would have it, Fortune discovered real-life vampirism through her study of the burgeoning school of psychoanalysis. Go figure. According to her and a number of other students, they noticed collectively that some of their clients were incredibly draining just to interact with. She even goes as far to suggest this phenomenon was measurable by certain types of electrical equipment. Although I find that hard to believe, maybe it's true. Concordant with vampire myth, the vampiric current usually flowed between pairs of people with close, often romantic relations.
At the same place, in the course of my psychoanalytical work, I came across a number of cases where a morbid attachment existed between two people, most commonly mother and daughter, or two women friends, sometimes also between mother and son, and in one case I met socially between a man and a woman. It was always the negative one of the pair who came for treatment, and we were able to benefit them considerably by psychotherapeutic means. They always showed the same symptom complex, a sensitive temperament, pallid complexion, wasted form, and general debility, sense of weakness, and easy fatigability.
Just like the vampire myths.
Sounds like my sister. I hope she doesn't listen to this show. They were also invariably highly suggestible, and were therefore easy to handle. Consequently, we were usually able to get good results pretty quickly in such cases. The curious point, however, was that the breaking of the morbid rapport caused a marked disturbance and even semi-collapse of the dominant partner in the alliance. We found it necessary to insist upon a separation if a cure were to be effected, and the separation invariably disagreed very actively with the dominant partner. At the time, I explained everything in terms of the Freudian psychology, but even so, I could not help being struck by the curious effect a separation had upon the person who was not supposed to be ill, and that as the one went uphill, the other went down. Oh, I've had relationships like this, like just with friends even.
Yeah, something about it hits home, doesn't it?
I mean, you just notice a pattern. It's like every time they're doing like awesome and want you to celebrate with them, like I feel like shit.
You're doing terribly. And
or like when I'm doing well, like they get sick or like need me to wait on them or like do something for them. Or
yeah,
they call me and instead of saying congrats, they're like, oh, I need help with this. Help me.
I have this interaction too, of course. I tell some of my good friends, you know, friends use each other. I'm a good vampire. You know, it's like in order for you to go faster, like if I have to push you for that to become the reality, that means I'm going to be tired or in some sort of slave end of things, you know, and it's vice versa. It's possible to do it together, but there's a whole other formula for propelling somebody. Like you're the rocket fuel and they're the object you're trying to get to land on the moon. You're just the fuel.
Sometimes I think it works almost like auric chemicals, like your aura interacts with another person's aura for some unknown reason, where I've had people that I genuinely like to spend time with that are not consciously messing with me, but almost every interaction I have with that person, especially a formal or pre-planned one, would tend to result in a negative outcome for me and a positive outcome for them every single time. I don't know why that is, but there have been people in my life more than once where this seems to be the case.
I think there's definitely methods to learn how to work with each other and still benefit from the highs and lows of your build, I guess, if you want to call it a party.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much how it is. That's why I think all this D&D stuff is very esoteric and your parents should be afraid if you're really young and playing seriously, because you're just going to be smarter than them. They don't want that.
I think a physical manifestation of this happening between a parent and their child would be Munchausen syndrome, where the parent is poisoning or convincing the child that they're sick in order that they receive more sympathy from the other grown-ups, etc.
It's Munchausen syndrome by proxy, is when the one person does it to another person without them knowing. But psychic vampires can also just have straight up Munchausen syndrome, where they pretend to be sick or they make themselves ill or hurt themselves to get attention.
Okay.
The parent to do that to a child, the by proxy syndrome, that's extremely common with this type of relationship.
So having dealt with witches and vampires, we arrive at yet another class of psychic threat, the plain old vanilla ghost haunting. Fortune says these usually come in two varieties. The first type owes itself to an actual dead person, a discarnate soul who is either unwilling or unable to move to the next plane of existence. The second owes itself to a lingering psychic disturbance in a location that is left behind like a sort of energetic residue. Dion Fortune claims that experiencing a haunting does not come easily to everyone, and as politically incorrect as it is today, this tendency is strongly said to be affected by one's race.
Gasp!
Dun dun dun!
Racism's in my psychology? It's more likely than you think.
Trigger warning! The following ideas do not belong to any of the actual humans that work on this podcast. We blame Dion Fortune for everything.
So, she writes, except in cases where the influence is exceptionally strong, the insensitive person is immune. To perceive a haunting, one needs, as a general rule, to be slightly psychic. It is for this reason that children, Celts, and the colored races suffer severely from such interferences. And the stolid Nordic type is comparatively immune, and to a lesser extent, the lively, materialistic, and skeptical Latin.
You hear that, Malcor?
Dude, I'm pretty much immune.
I thought you were Celtic.
I am. It says that they're immune.
No, it says the Celts are like wicked sensitive.
Well, I've got some Latin in there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm the Latin one.
Yeah, I mean, I got Latin blood and Hungarian blood.
Well, I do believe I am psychic and sensitive to such things, but I have never witnessed a haunting or any kind of like spooky ghost or anything like that.
It's this kind of that got J.K. Rowling in a lot of trouble, by the way, too. She included this discussion in her fiction.
Oh, no, no, no. We don't do that these days. Of course, needless to say, in our modern world, making these types of racial distinctions, especially concerning spiritual qualities, is strictly taboo territory. Maybe for good reason. Sadly, Dion Fortune takes it to a whole new level and is guilty of declaring racial tropes fitting of the fiction famous of H.P. Lovecraft. In the section concerning non-human contexts, she says,
tropical vegetation, as a whole, is overpowerful for humanity. Under the tremendous stimulation of the solar fire, the elemental forces are concentrated to a poisonous strength. I am not personally acquainted with the west coast of Africa, but from what I can gather, I am of the opinion that the elemental forces and the atmosphere made by the juju rites are between them more responsible than the climate for earning that part of the world its sinister reputation as the white man's grave. Fucking getting racy here again.
I mean, to play devil's advocate here, she is saying respect cultures and their beliefs and don't just tread on their dark forces. I shouldn't say it like that.
Right? It's I mean, this is like when the blues came to America and they're like, that's the devil. So I couldn't help but notice it was probably this exact sentiment which was repeated enough to sublimate into the racially charged film trope that Spike Lee dubbed The Magic Negro, where a black supporting character is given exotic magic ability, which is then given in service selflessly to the white hero protagonist and almost always at their own expense. A perfect example of this trope, which is also faithful to the claims Fortune is here making, would be Doc Halloran from The Shining. Edward of the Green Mile is yet another famous example. On the flip side, the Wachowski siblings played critically with this trope to great effect in The Matrix with Lawrence Fishburne's character Morpheus, who at one point attempts to offer his life in order to save Neo, who, seeing the trope for what it is, rejects it outright, opting to sacrifice himself so the rebellion can continue with competent leadership. We see this relationship continue in the third John Wick film, which doubles down on rejecting this stereotype. Like John Wick falls from grace and he ends up in Lawrence Fishburne's kingdom and he's like, can you just help me out? And Lawrence Fishburne's like, what are you gonna do for me? You know what I mean? Like, oh, you're just expecting me to just like give you a machine gun and my whole army, you know, to like save your legacy, Mr. John Wick? Like, they totally dispense with that whole trope.
And it's the same actors.
It's the same actors, yes. I just thought it was crazy that these wacky ideas Dion Fortune helped popularize are still tropes in our film and entertainment today. Just blows my mind. All this being said, there's almost nobody sincerely interested in spirituality who believes one's ancestral heritage should be entirely ignored. In fact, it was during Dion Fortune's era that it suddenly became very hip for occultists to claim Celtic heritage, real or imagined, for exactly the reasons stated here. For example, when Aleister Crowley attempted a hostile takeover of the Golden Dawn on behalf of his mentor, MacGregor Mathers, it was in full Scottish regalia. To bring popular film back into it, I have no doubt this was precisely what George Lucas was playing with when he came up with the idea of the Sith, who are analogous to how occultists of this era viewed Celtic ancestry. Then, Celtic ancestry itself, at least according to its native mythos, holds that its origins are in the other world, and its inhabitants are the fairy folk, who are in turn called the She, which, despite its vastly different pronunciation, is spelled identical to Sith of Star Wars acclaim. That being said, hauntings are usually not in the business of being outright malevolent, even when said haunting is caused by an intelligent spirit.
As far as my experience goes, I'm inclined to think that deliberate malevolence is rare, but this panic-stricken clinging is not uncommon, and explains why the survivor of a pair sometimes goes through very unpleasant experiences after the death of the partner. There are also cases, though rarer, when a soul who has some occult knowledge but is bound strongly to earth by sensual desires uses a curious form of rapport in order to gratify those desires through the physical body of another. So, kind of, it's Grand Theft Auto, but Grand Theft Body?
Yes, essentially, the classic haunting, when at the fault of a specific spirit, is usually due to a panicked clinging to the material world in the post-death state. This is partially due to our culture's rejection, ignorance, and subsequent fear of death, which Fortune suggests a more prolific culture of spiritualism would help ease. Here's looking at you, Dan Aykroyd. Tibetan Buddhism combats this by reading the recently deceased a post-death handbook of sorts called the Bardo Thodol, which is intended to ease the passage into the next world. One thing both Fortune and the Tibetan Buddhists hold is that undue clinging by a surviving party is capable of causing the recently deceased to cling back, which results in an unsettling amount of paranormal activity and a draining of vital energetic life force. That sounds bad. Apparently, ghosts need to eat if they want to maintain their astral bodies, which, if they become good enough at, can eventually become ghoulish specters that survive off the vital energy of living humans. Almost like a vampire.
Oh, it's kind of like in Beetlejuice or the Monsters, Inc. movie where they have to like get enough screams in. They got to get their quota of screams.
Yes.
So it's so they can maintain their physical form.
And everybody wants to be Randall, not the good monster.
I mean, he looks cool, but is he cool?
These vampiric forces are even capable of eating your pee or your poop in some cultures to feed themselves because it's from your body.
Oh, that's crazy. I recently watched a horror game on Twitch. It's like an indie developer that's really famous. She's from Japan, and it's like it was this old rundown Japanese house that was haunted, and there was the ghost like for half the game hung out in the outhouse toilet and you'd have to like bring it items and stuff, and that's like, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. So Fortune continues on and says, in the other type of haunting, that in which it is the place which is the focus of manifestation, not a special person, we must distinguish between the earthbound entity which remains attached to a particular spot and the thought atmosphere which is left left behind after violent emotions have been experienced there. Let us consider first the question of thought atmosphere, of which I can give a very illuminating example. A friend of mine who was a student at a school of dramatic art consulted me concerning attack of stage fright she had, which left her rather nervous as to its recurrence. She was an experienced student, in fact, a pupil teacher, and she was having some extra tuition from the head of the school. Going for her lesson one afternoon, she found that her teacher had just finished taking the junior students for their end of the term examination in elocution.
Public speaking, basically.
I had no idea what that meant. Because I'm bad at public speaking, but yes. She went on to the stage and stood beside the small table which had been placed there for the convenience of the examiner and commenced to recite the piece on which she was to have her lesson. She herself had no occasion for nervousness, as had already been noted. She was an experienced speaker and teacher. Moreover, nothing of importance hung upon this lesson. It was merely one of a series. Nor was she usually nervous or self-conscious, but as soon as she tried to start, she experienced a complete dry-up and stood paralyzed, unable to utter a word. A little prompting soon started her off, however, but she had experienced a nasty attack of stage fright and it shook her nerve.
That reminds me of one time I went camping with some friends at a place where there were natural pools of water that you could like jump into from like really high. And the first night I was there, like I couldn't get myself to do it. And I was really embarrassed because it was almost like I was stuck. And the more I tried, the more stuck I got. And the only way I was able to overcome it was I woke up first thing in the morning, just ran up there and just jumped off like right away. I think it had something to do with this whole thing where it was like my nervousness would just like, it kept building and building and building and building and building. And then it was like its own gravity. I couldn't escape it.
And then notice when you wake up, your consciousness isn't quite there yet. Like you have to kind of catch up with your body in the morning. So you're able to make the decision from your subconscious and not necessarily, you know, your active consciousness.
Yeah, the gears weren't all clogged up first thing in the morning. So I was like, all right, I better do this. Boop. You know what? And I did it. So
she continues on. From the psychic point of view, the explanation was not far to seek. She was standing in the mental atmosphere created by a series of girls who had gone on to that platform for an examination upon which a good deal depended for them, and who had all been correspondingly nervous. She herself, being sensitive, had been affected by this atmosphere, which induced her in a similar mental state by means which is called sympathetic induction, a phenomenon well known in electricity and acoustics, but equally valid in psychology. No doubt the unfortunate examinees themselves were infecting each other. It may well be that the microphone panic, so well known to broadcasters, is caused by the thought atmosphere generated by a succession of nervous people who have stood upon the same spot.
You know, this actually reminds me of rioting as well.
Yeah, it's been proven in psychology. If you're literally witnessing a group of other human beings doing an activity, everyone will do the activity like 110% of their normal, like you actually gain skill by having the visual sight of other people doing it. But she's talking about people that were there before and the girl couldn't see them, but she picked up on that energy, the residue.
Yes.
So this is interesting because the physical, it was a past event that is influencing the present, which I think is kind of interesting. And I actually do have, I've experienced this myself. If I'm in a large crowd, for example, I'll pick up on emotions and feelings that are not mine. Like this makes more sense if it, maybe it happened a while ago, or maybe it's just like lagging and I'm just in this cloud of emotions that I'm picking up and it becomes overwhelming because you're like, I don't know why I feel this way, but I feel like all messed up.
I always think of like, that's why the beach is so relaxing, because it's virtually untouched by any sort of like structure and culture for the most part. And when people arrive there, it's like almost like a unanimous feeling of, I feel I can relax here. And
yeah,
it's serene. And you can say that for a lot of parts of nature, but the beach is especially like, it's not that dangerous. You don't
people
have
go
to
there
the
to relax. So you yeah. can only feel more relaxed by that.
Yeah, it's sweet.
It's a very interesting observation. The Unfortunate continues with the same principle, but in a more relatable example, something you'd expect from a haunting.
An experience of my own may be of interest in this connection. I took a bed sitting room in a hostel, and as soon as I came there, I found myself afflicted with the most intense depression. I'm not usually subject to the blues, being normally a cheerful soul, but as soon as I entered this room, which was a sunny and pleasant one, the cloud descended upon me, but lifted again as soon as I went out of it, whether into the dining room of the hostel or out of doors. I soon recognized that here was something that needed to be dealt with and inquired as to the history of the room. I was told that it had previously been the bedroom of the last owner of the house, who had been addicted to drink and had gone bankrupt. It is a curious fact that drunkards and drug addicts make very evil psychic atmospheres, whereas a person who is a common criminal, however bad, is not nearly so noxious and his atmosphere fades rapidly. In these two cases, there was no such question of an entity, discarnate or incarnate, being concerned in the matter. There was merely an unpleasant mental atmosphere generated by some powerful and painful emotion that had been experienced over a considerable period at that spot. Such a concentration, if very strong, will linger almost indefinitely. The structures that saw the concentration may have been pulled down and new ones built, but nevertheless, the forces remain, like a previous exposure on a photographic plate, and sensitive people are affected by them. The insensitive may escape comparatively scatheless.
It's like when someone burns toast, Danny. Now eat your f***ing ice cream. Objects can also be haunted, which is often done purposefully by occultists when consecrating certain ritual tools or talismans. For instance, a cross blessed by a bishop will emanate a distinctly different vibe than an unconsecrated cross of the same sort that you just, you know, pick up at the grocery store.
Objects associated with any form of ceremonial operations are invariably highly charged with magnetism and intimately linked with the force whose uses they have served.
This is also true of spaces that have been charged for ritual use, with Christian monasteries and vicarages being no exception. Naturally, haunted places can be subject to odd knocks, bangs, shuffling, or unexplained footsteps. But these are generally not a danger unless they accompany other, more dangerous phenomena, like, you know, fires lighting themselves spontaneously where they shouldn't. Fortune even includes an entry from the Confessions of Aleister Crowley concerning the nature of a haunting caused by ceremonial magic in which the forces were not properly dispersed.
I try to do a Crowley voice, but I'm still under the weather a little. I'll just read it with gusto. The demons connected with Abermelin do not wait to be invoked. They come unsought. One night, Jones and I went out to dinner. I noticed on leaving the White Temple that the latch of its Yale lock had not caught. Accordingly, I pulled the door to and tested it. As we went out, we noticed semi-solid shadows on the stairs. The whole atmosphere was vibrating with the forces we had been using. We were trying to condense them into sensible images. When we came back, nothing had been disturbed in the flat, but the temple door was wide open, the furniture disarranged, and some of the symbols flung about the room. We restored order and then observed that semi-materialized beings were marching round the main room in almost unending procession. When I finally left the flat for Scotland, it was found that the mirrors were too big to take out, save by the way of the Black Temple. This had, of course, been completely dismantled before the workmen arrived, and the atmosphere remained, and two of them were put out of action for several hours. It was almost a weekly experience, by the way, to hear of casual callers fainting or being seized with dizziness, cramp, or apoplexy on the staircase. It was a long time before these rooms were relit. People felt instinctively the presence of something uncanny.
So there's actually two more sections laying out two other sources of psychic attack, but we're going to save those for the next episode. But in terms of this episode, in the extended format, we're going to talk about the first line of defense that Dion Fortune suggests, and then launch straight into a Hermetic Magic 101 section that tells you how to use the Kabbalistic Cross and perform a lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram. Iris, what are you doing? That was actually part of my altar falling over.
Ooh-wee-oo.
But if you'd like to hear and learn about that, please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 would not only get you this extended episode, but every single goddamn one of our episodes stretching back like over 4 years now. Five? How old are we anyway? But not only that, I'll send you a 5x5 high quality vinyl sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, and you'll get the secret keys to our Discord server, where you can talk to us about all the ways you like to banish disincarnate entities using clown feet flavored popcorn. My favorite. Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots and shoot lasers.
Pew, pew, pew.